This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a celebration of chamber music, a visual history project honoring the legacy of Creoles of color, or a classic drama in pursuit of the American dream, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. If you are a chamber music aficionado, you may want to clear your calendar next week. That's when the Birdfoot Festival kicks off its third celebration of live chamber music at venues all over town. Joining me now to talk about the events is Festival Artistic Director Jenna Sherry. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you so much for having me.
Birdfoot is relatively new, a new music festival that's gaining traction. What are your thoughts about its success as you gear up for your third celebration?
There's something about the number three that just is a great feeling. The first year was great. The second year was great. In this third year, it's really the first time when I go around town and people already know what the Birdfoot Festival is, and I don't get Birdfoot Festival what? And that's just a great feeling.
How does this festival fit into our city's rich musical culture?
I see chamber music as a classical equivalent to a small jazz combo. In a way, I want to bring the experience of chamber music to make it a similar experience to what we're used to in New Orleans when we go out to a little jazz club. That intimate environment and that energy and the connection you feel with the musicians and the sort of electric atmosphere. In New Orleans, we have such eclectic musical tastes that I think chamber music should be a real sort of vital living part of that.
This is a big gift to your hometown. What led you to launch a festival of this nature 3 years ago?
I'm a classical musician myself, and at some point the thought struck me, why do we listen to classical music in a different way? Why do we have to put our hands in our lap and stay quiet and we're not really supposed to have a great time? To me, as someone who's devoting my life to performing chamber music, I wanted to bring the experience that the audience had of interacting with it closer to what I experienced growing up in New Orleans.
And the name, Birdfoot?
Our first board president, Mark Groudon, who is a geologist, came up with that. Birdfoot is a name that geologists give to the Mississippi River Delta. They call it the Birdfoot Delta. And we thought that it was nice because it was a bit quirky, a bit imaginative, but it gave the festival a sense of place on the river, which sort of gives New Orleans its life.
So now, what can chamber music lovers look forward to this year? What's new?
Oh, we've got such a great lineup this year, and I'm really excited to share it. We kick off on May 26th, Monday evening, and we have a chamber music reading party. We're inviting amateur musicians, really anyone if they want, but especially amateur musicians, to come out and join us reading through chamber music. Then Tuesday evening, we've got a musical feast with Chef Susan Spicer, who has just been incredibly generous in donating her time. This is going to be in the top floor of Place St. Charles. Wednesday night, we have our first concert in C, which is going to be at Cafe Istanbul, and we're going to do an entire program in C around Terry Riley's iconic sort of minimalist work, one of the first minimalist masterpieces. And everything else, of course, is going to be in C. On Thursday night, we've got Birdfoot backstage at the JCC Uptown, where we're going to be discussing Schubert's Trout Quintet. Here's a piece of chamber music based on a song about a fish. Yep, for real. And we're going to be joined in that. This is late breaking news, and I'm very excited. We're going to be joined by prominent musicologists William Kinderman and Catherine Sire and all of our musicians, and I think it's going to be a really lively, fun discussion about this music. On Friday night, join us at the CAC for a concert called Mania and Madrigals. This is a concert I'm really looking forward to. We're going to be sort of exploring the old and the new and where they intersect with Gesualdo Madrigals. Gesualdo was just a crazy guy, Prince of Venosa, and he sort of rocked Italy with the scandalous murder of his wife and her lover in the 16th century. This was sort of really a big deal, and because he was a prince, he got away with it. But it sort of seems that he was racked with guilt the rest of his life, and he wrote this wild music. So we're going to perform some of his music. We're going to perform a 20th century piece for a large ensemble of 18 musicians, and we're going to be joined by a bunch of local musicians, a piece based on his crazy story. And we're also going to be performing a piece that I just love by contemporary composer Caroline Shaw, who just won the big Pulitzer Prize for music last year. And this is a wonderful piece that sort of draws on the old and presents it in a fresh new way. And then on Saturday, we wrap up the festival with a big gala celebration at Dixon Hall on the Tulane campus. And this is going to have some great music. Schubert's Trout Quintet and the Renski Quartet for two cellos and violin and viola that's rarely performed. Janacek's second quartet, Intimate Letters.
Tell me more about the musicians. Who are the musicians that perform with Birdfoot?
We've got a really wide range of musicians. We've got a lot of returning musicians. Audiences will recognize violinist Chris Tong, who's in the Borromeo Quartet. He's coming back for the third year. We just can't keep him away. We also have a violist, Roger Chase, joining us, who's taught in Chicago for many years, although he's originally from the United Kingdom. We've got musicians from all over the U.S., several different countries, and this year we've got four local musicians joining us, and I'm really looking forward to this. Several musicians who play in the LPO, including principal percussionist Nina Lorenz and several violinists.
You too are a classical violinist. Will you be performing?
I will be performing several things. A Haydn string quartet on the Café Istanbul concert. It's the Haydn Quartet Opus 20 No. 2, and if anyone knows it, I think they'll know why I love it so much. I'll be performing the Caroline Shaw Quartet on the Friday night concert, and I'll also be performing in Schubert's Trout Quintet on the final concert.
You're juggling your time between New Orleans and the UK?
I am, and you know, I never feel like I have enough time to do everything I want in either place. It's sort of a constant sense of frustration for me. But every time I come back to New Orleans, I just sort of feel this, I'm home, and it's so great to be back. But right now I'm employed in the UK, so that's a good reason to spend a lot of time there, and I've got a lot of musical projects going on. Both of these places sort of feed my energy and complement each other.
Now, this year you have a residency at the CAC. Is that new?
This is new, and this is a very exciting collaboration for us. It's a very exciting place for us to be based because we're going to be right downtown, sort of in the middle of the downtown arts district. We're going to have sort of a more public role in the community, and I'm hoping this will allow us to invite the community in to get closer to what's going on artistically and feel more a part of the artistic process.
So you truly are in venues all across New Orleans.
We really are.
Jenna Sherry, Birdfoot Festival Artistic Director, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The Birdfoot Festival kicks off Monday, May 26th, and runs through Saturday, May 31st. More info at birdfootfestival.org. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO. I'm Diane Mack. Pastel portraits on paper bring to life notable 18th and 19th century Creoles of color. In the exhibit, New Orleans Free People of Color and Their Legacy, on view at Le Musée. The visual history project is by award-winning artist and writer Jose Torres Tama, who joins us now with Museum Director Beverly McKenna. Welcome to the program.
Great to
be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This must be a very exciting time for you as your exhibit, celebrating and documenting cultural contributions by free people of color, is being remounted at Le Musée. Tell us about the exhibit and how did it come about?
It was originally developed with the Ogden Museum. So it's an Ogden Museum traveling show right now that's going to be presented at Le Musée du FPC. And FPC is the denomination, as Beverly will tell you, for free people of color. Beverly and I have been talking about this for some time because once she was letting me know about the development of this new house museum dedicated in a very regal manner to celebrating the legacy of the New Orleans Free People of Color, we thought that it would be a great exhibit to go hand in hand. But this project was developed over a seven-year period with the historian Keith Weldon Medley. His book, We as Free Men, has been very seminal to the project. Many of the portraits that I've created are based on archival photographs found in books like his, We as Free Men, and also Sybil Kind's Creole. So what I've done is basically use these archival photographs to create contemporary portraits, expressionistic and colorful, of this hybrid caste, which are people that came of being during the French and Spanish colonial time period, and a mixture of a tolerated but illegal racial mixing of French, African, Spanish, and Native. A lot of times people forget the Native, but they were a hybrid caste born into freedom during slavery, which is pretty amazing. And it's not something that we are really taught. And only because I've lived in a neighborhood like the Marigny, and I've lived in the Bywater for a minute, you know, but also at the end of the French Quarter and very close to the Treme, these were the neighborhoods that were founded by free people of color.
Now, Beverly, tell us about Le Musée.
Le Musée is a house museum that my husband and I founded. It's a result of a collection since we were in our very early 30s, collecting the material culture along with photographs, books, manumission papers, freedom documents, portraits, oil paintings, watercolors. It just became a lifelong passion of ours. Things that reflected the history, the contributions of free people of color. After the storm, after Katrina, our collection survived. Everything survived. So we took that as a sign that we should bring our collection out and share it. We just thought it was an important story that wasn't being told.
Now, Jose, can you tell us about your interest in the contributions of Creoles of color? When did it begin?
I'm a hybrid myself. I'm a mestizo. I'm mixed race. I'm Spanish. I'm also indigenous. I'm from Ecuador, so I have Andean native Ecuadorian blood. And I also have German. Tom is an actual German name. So mixed race people are of great interest to me. I mean, that's the history of the New World, right? We are a mixed race people because of the colonization of so many Europeans. Well, here I am in New Orleans, and I start stumbling upon this phrase, free people of color, gens de couleur libre. And I'm like, who are these people? And I begin researching, and I'm just dumbfounded at the fact that there's not enough information about these people here, that a lot of this information post-Reconstruction was buried because of the Jim Crow South laws. So I decided that I was going to investigate this, and I wanted to create a pictorial history of individuals who did quite a bit to try to dismantle the slave South and challenge its institutional prejudices. So you have folks like Dr. Louise Charles Rudenay, who was from St. James Parish, who establishes in the Treme the Tribune, the newspaper.
The newspaper that has the same name as your newspaper, Beverly.
It does. We founded our paper almost 30 years ago now. And when we were talking about putting this together, we saw the need for another voice. And because we were aware of Dr. Rudenay and his strong voice, his advocacy for the enslaved, for the free, he spoke for everybody. He was an early voice for civil rights, really, and justice for everybody. And we were so admiring of his editorial content and the respect that his paper garnered. You know, we have letters from Frederick Douglass, you know, who was a reader of his publication. And so that's how we came to call our paper the New Orleans Tribune.
Yeah. Who are some of the others that we might learn about?
Speaking of writers, who was just an amazing advocacy for freedom, Rodolphe Lucien de Dune. De Dune eventually writes the most famous book called Nos Hommes et Notre Histoire, Our People and Our History. He catalogs literally some of the most activist individuals of this hybrid caste, musicians, artists, women as well, and who are challenging the injustices of their time. And De Dune was such an admirable writer that when you look at his writings, calling for freedom, it's like he's writing contemporary concerns that you can apply towards the Patriot Act and its difficulties then. There's also Arnold Burton now. It's an Henrietta DeLille. There's Marie Couvent, whose story is amazingly epic as well. She's brought here from Guinea as a slave child of 7 years old. in the late 1800s, eventually marries Bernard Couvent, a free man of color. She becomes free and is left with all these properties. One of the lesser known aspects about women and property is that the first women in these United States to own property were free women of color.
Now, Jose, tell us how you tell the stories through your pastel portraits.
Pictorially, what I try to do is give people some kind of idea that these are people who have passed. And it began with the composition of Marie Laveau, where you see there's a tombstone that frames each person, right? But there's also this reddish aura, because as I began finding out about these people, these folks did amazing things, even though they were free people of color, during a time where their freedoms were actually very much diminished. You know, people were trying to control their freedoms quite often. And in fact, they had to have papers to prove that they were free men and women of color. So I want people to walk away with an understanding that this city has an incredible legacy. These were amazing folks that many of them could have aligned themselves with more of their European heritage. But much to the surprise of many, those who were even could pass for white aligned themselves with their African heritage to support the causes of freedom for many people. So I want people to walk away with an understanding that, yes, when we say that this city has been built on the shoulders of many, it has been built on the shoulders of a tremendous African legacy. And also for them to understand that this happened in the slave South, where it didn't happen anywhere else, where free people, Creoles, had power. And they influenced social and political ideas of their times.
Artist Jose Torres Tama and Le Musée director Beverly McKenna, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, my dear.
Jose Torres Tama's exhibit, New Orleans Free People of Color and Their Legacy, a traveling exhibit of the Ogden Museum of Southern Art with support from the Joan Mitchell Foundation of New York, will be on display at Le Musée from May 23rd through July 11th. There will be an opening reception at Le Musée, 2336 Esplanade Avenue, Friday at 6 p.m. We turn now to a classic American drama. Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman is now in final days at Le Petit Theatre. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play, first performed in 1949, continues to draw audiences. Joining me now is director Amy Holtkamp. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What is it about this Pulitzer Prize-winning script that continues to win over audiences?
Well, I think at its heart, it's a story about family. It's about a father and a son. And so that universal connection that we all feel towards that primal relationship that we all have to our parents, I think that's a huge part of what still speaks to people so many years after Arthur Miller wrote this play.
This is a story of ultimate sacrifice in pursuit of the American dream. How do you tell the story of traveling salesman Willie Loman?
Part of our challenge is to bring to life this play that many people have read in high school, read in college, may have a preconceived idea of what this play should be. And so I think that the way that we went about telling the story was to look for what we all connected with in the relationships and with the situations that the characters find themselves in, to try to personalize the story as much as possible. It's really a play about a man who has worked really hard for his entire life as a traveling salesman to try to leave something behind for his two sons, Happy and Biff. And Willie Loman is now at the point in his life where it's looking like he may not be able to continue to work. And he's looking around and thinking about all of the hopes and dreams that he had for himself and for his family, and seeing that time is running out and that they may not come true. And this story is really about that feeling of panic that sets on when you realize that all of those things that you wished for when your little children were babies, time's running out for you to make that happen for them.
So who's in the cast?
Well, the cast is led by George Sanchez as Willie Loman. His wife, Linda, is played by Mary Pauley, who was just recently nominated for two Big Easy Awards. And his two sons are played by Garrett Prejean as Biff and Chris Maroy as Happy. And then we have just a wonderful ensemble cast. One of the wonderful things about working on this play has been that even characters that only appear for one little scene are played by actors who could really carry a whole show on their own. So there isn't a weak link to be found in the cast. And they've just been wonderful to work with.
How would you say that this play is relevant to today's audiences?
A lot of the things Arthur Miller was very worried about, or that were on his mind, I think, when he wrote this play in 1949, those concerns he had about the direction America was heading in, I feel have only intensified and gotten worse in the time since he wrote this, honestly. I think one of the things that he was seeing was a movement towards workers being disposable, a lack of loyalty on the part of companies for their workers and vice versa. Willie has a great line in the play where he's talking to his boss and he says, "A man is not a piece of fruit. You can't eat the orange and throw the peel away." And, you know, I think especially in light of the recent economic crisis that we've all been through, we're seeing, and I think a lot of us are feeling, that we are being viewed as pieces of fruit, that our best years are being used up by our jobs, and then maybe we're let go or we're left without our retirement fund or losing our house. I think that there actually is a lot of relevance in Willie's situation here. He's based his whole life on this job and with the idea that there were promises that were made to him. And now he's finding that those promises may not be kept.
What does that say to today's audiences about the American dream?
Arthur Miller has some good suggestions about that. I think he would say that our American dream, we have to make sure that it's our dream, that we have to know ourselves and know what our actual hopes and dreams and goals are, rather than adopting a set of expectations and hopes and dreams that are handed to us about what success looks like.
Amy, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Amy Holtkamp directs Arthur Miller's Pulitzer Prize-winning drama, Death of a Salesman, at Le Petit Theatre, 616 St. Peter Street. Performances run through Saturday. More info at lepetittheatre.com. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go inside the arts. I'm Diane Mack.